From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US will continue to lead, but the burden can be shared. President Obama outlines his vision for US foreign policy.
But US military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
Also today, we find out how EU leaders have reacted to the gains made by the far right in those recent EU elections. And we look at the extraordinary life and work of the late poet, author and activist Maya Angelou.
I want to write so that that reader can say, you know, that's the truth. That's the truth, yeah. I wasn't there and I wasn't a 6-foot-tall black girl. But that's the truth. That's human.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has outlined his foreign policy model just a day after announcing plans to end the U.S. military role in Afghanistan. Mr. Obama also announced a new $5 billion counterterrorism partnership. Speaking at West Point Military Academy, Mr. Obama said America still plays a leading role in global security.
I believe we have a real stake, abiding self-interest, in making sure our children and our grandchildren grow up in a world where schoolgirls are not kidnapped and where individuals are not slaughtered because of tribe or faith or political belief.
The acclaimed American poet and author Maya Angelou has died at the age of 86. The author of 7 memoirs, including the highly influential I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, she'd been suffering from ill health for several weeks. Our U.S. correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Maya Angelou was an American original for more than 5 decades, raising cultural issues facing African Americans in a manner that resonated with millions. Last year, she told Time magazine she couldn't imagine a moment when she wouldn't be writing.
If there is time, I'll probably be writing when the Lord says, Maya, Maya Angelou, it's time. I'll probably be writing a poem or trying to write some music or an autobiography.
She read a poem at Bill Clinton's inauguration and was awarded the Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama.
Chechnya's president, Ramzan Kadyrov, has denied sending troops to Ukraine to fight Kiev's forces alongside pro-Russian separatists. In a statement, the Chechen leader denied Ukrainian reports that some Chechen units from Russia have invaded Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. Anya Ardaeva reports from the Russian capital.
Moscow-backed president of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, said Chechnya, being part of the Russian Federation, had no armed forces on its own. He denied Ukrainian reports that some Chechen units were sent to Donetsk and said that any Chechens operating in Ukraine were there in a personal capacity. Up to 100 people were killed in the town of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine as the region saw some of the worst fighting in recent days. Ukraine's Interior Ministry says the country's military is now in full control of the airport.
Google has announced plans to begin building its own self-driving electric-powered cars. In the past, Google has modified other manufacturers' vehicles to create their smart cars. The tech giant says it expects to begin test drives on their new automobiles by the end of the year. The cars will be two-seaters with a stop-and-go button, but sans a steering wheel or foot pedals. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Edward Snowden says he was trained as a spy, working under an assumed name around the world to protect American secrets. He sat down for his first television interview with American broadcaster NBC News after he released hundreds of thousands of classified documents. And in his own interview with NBC News, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the fugitive whistleblower needs to come home and trust in American justice. Here's Priscilla Huff from Washington.
Edward Snowden told NBC News he was trained as a spy, working with the CIA, NSA, and Defense Intelligence Agency.
So when they say I'm a low-level systems administrator, that I don't know what I'm talking about, I'd say it's somewhat misleading.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told NBC News the fugitive whistleblower is a thief who stole American intelligence.
He can come home, but he's a fugitive from justice, which is why he's not being permitted to fly around the world. It's that simple.
Edward Snowden says he developed sources and methods to keep American intelligence safe in the most dangerous places in the world.
And European leaders are at odds over who will take the EU's top job as the next president of the European Commission. According to EU treaties, the winner of parliamentary elections, which wrapped up over the weekend, gets the official nomination. But not all countries are supporting Jean-Claude Juncker, the lead candidate. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
Tuesday's late-night talks among EU leaders revealed rifts over whether the Council of 28 Nations will nominate Jean-Claude Juncker as the next European Commission president. The former Prime Minister of Luxembourg is the leader of the centre-right EPP party, which won the most votes in pan-European parliamentary elections last week. But loose wording in EU treaties mean European leaders could choose someone else. The UK's Prime Minister David Cameron is among those opposed to Juncker because of his federalist views.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
America must always lead on the world stage. If we don't, no one else will. The military that you have joined is and always will be the backbone of that leadership. But U.S. military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
President Obama outlining his vision for U.S. foreign policy to an audience of military graduates at West Point Academy. Under fire from critics calling his handling of overseas issues ineffective and weak, this was Mr. Obama's attempt to defend his record and address the multitude of challenges ahead. Just a day after announcing the complete withdrawal of US troops from Afghanistan, Mr. Obama insisted that while the US will continue to lead, the burden of international action could be shared among nations, a statement backed up by a new $5 billion counter-terrorism partnership fund. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and I began by asking him if the future of US foreign policy was any clearer.
You know, I'm not so sure, partly because I always sense that Mr. Obama was doing a little better than a lot of people wanted to say, and that he obviously was not reluctant to use force when absolutely necessary, but that he's painfully aware of the implications of doing so. He's the guy who meets the caskets at Dover and writes the condolence letters and visits the troops and answers the prayers or the letters anyway of troops' families. So he understands what we're talking about when we're talking about war, and he's made it pretty clear that he's prepared to keep using force against al-Qaeda, against Iran, if there's no other way to prevent it from getting a nuclear bomb, to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan much longer than he himself would emotionally prefer. So, you know, I always saw him as a reluctant but still, willing warrior when the cause and the stakes were appropriate. And so I didn't maybe have as many questions as some people. The people who do have questions or did have questions probably still have them, because in a lot of cases their questions arose not over some general philosophy on when and how to use force, but over very specific decisions and a perception that the United States is seen as too reluctant or, too unwilling to commit force abroad these days. I don't think that perception is necessarily accurate, but for those who had it, I don't know what Mr. Obama might have said that would have changed their mind. You know, he could have reminded people that we've stayed in Afghanistan many, many years on his watch and done a lot of fighting. He could have reminded people that we still have typically two aircraft carriers near Iran at any time ready to strike if need be. He could have reminded people that he continues to use drones when necessary. And he did say that, of course, at one brief moment. But my point is that, you know, he didn't really make a full-throated defense of his foreign policy. He seemed to want to debate the intellectual back and forth on whether you should be more muscular. And he was, I think, you know, directing most of his rebuttals against the hawks in the U.S. debate who seemed to want him to do more. And I'm just not sure the theological level debate really is going to change too many minds. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't see any huge problem here. I mean, Vladimir Putin seems to be keeping his hands off the Ukrainian election, for example. And so I think on balance, even though we have some specific problems in places like Syria, it's hardly the case that the world is falling apart because of supposed American retrenchment. So, again, I saw the problem is not so severe in the first place. and therefore I didn't need to be persuaded. But those who did need to be persuaded, I'm not sure they heard anything all that new.
He clearly wants to be the war-ending U.S. president, but he, nor did he dismiss unilateral force entirely, if needed. But he was championing this collective action, wasn't he? Can he have both?
Well, you know, it was such a... You're right, he said all those things, and they're in some tension with each other, but they're all also correct. Even George W. Bush would have basically agreed with that. You want to have allies when you can. You only use force when you by yourself when you feel you must. You know, it's not so interesting when you just couch it in these broad terms, especially because the president's already given these kinds of speeches before, for example, at Oslo in 2009 when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. So the first time he gave this sort of a speech that recognized the dueling tensions and pressures any American president must face, it was interesting to hear the words that he chose and the way that he explained the thought process in his own head. Today, I found it just inherently less interesting, probably because it was less newsworthy. We're almost 6 years into this presidency, and I find the more interesting questions, how do you apply these general principles to specific cases like Syria or Afghanistan, not whether you have to always balance one concern against another, because that, you know, is sort of obvious at this point, and we already have heard the president talk on this subject before.
President Obama, he has, as you already mentioned, Russia's intervention in Ukraine and the Iran nuclear issue weighing heavy on his shoulders. But I wanted to ask you about Syria. Do we feel that the questions over that situation have been answered today?
No, I didn't think they were answered. The president certainly indicated that he would do a little more on Syria. But I have two things to say by way of response. First of all, there weren't that many specifics. And secondly, we've heard this president promise to do more on Syria before, only to decide to hold back on numerous occasions, often on the basis of decisions that we don't hear about publicly when they happen. So I'm not accusing the president of dishonesty. I think he's wrestling with serious concerns in his own head all the time, but I'm not easily persuaded either. And until he tells me something pretty specific or pretty resolute about his new thinking on Syria, I'm going to have to place it in the context of a series of decisions that have been notable for 3 years for their, restraint is the polite word. Timidity at times seems to be another word that comes to mind. He just hasn't wanted to engage much on this question. And again, I understand his reluctance, but it's been so deeply felt and so deeply rooted that anything he says now by way of being willing to do a little bit more makes me skeptical in the first instance.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute. This is FSN Reports. US author, poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou has died at the age of 86 in North Carolina. She'd been suffering from ill health for several weeks. In a career that spanned more than five decades, she raised cultural issues facing African Americans in a manner that resonated with millions of people. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Maya Angelou was an American original, for more than five decades raising cultural issues facing African Americans in a manner that resonated with millions. For more than 50 years, she won plaudits and honors for her writings and poetry about her upbringing in the American South and the challenges faced in modern times by African Americans. Last year, she told Time magazine she couldn't imagine a time when she wouldn't be writing.
I want to write so that the reader in Des Moines, Iowa, in Kowloon, China, in Cape Town, Pretoria, South Africa, in Harlem, in Boston. I want to write so that that reader can say, that's the truth. That's the truth, yeah. I wasn't there and I wasn't a 6-foot-tall black girl. But that's the truth. That's human.
She read one of her poems at Bill Clinton's inauguration and was awarded the Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama.
Here, on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
One of her most famous poems, Still I Rise, was published in 1978 and speaks of the strength and resilience of her community. In Maya Angelou's own voice, here's an excerpt.
Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sassiness upset you?
Her groundbreaking memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, made history as one of the first nonfiction bestsellers by an African-American woman. A key figure in America's civil rights movement, she talked about the struggle this way.
The hells we have lived through and live through still have sharpened our senses and toughened our will.
And she also talked of the abuse she suffered as a child.
I was 7 and a half, and my 7 and a half year old logic deduced that my voice had killed him. So I stopped speaking for almost 6 years.
Maya Angelou's death comes less than a week after she announced she wouldn't be attending the Major League Basketball Beacon Awards luncheon, where she was to be honored due to health problems. Her last tweet was 5 days ago. She said, "Listen to yourself, and in that quietude, you might hear the voice of God."
FSN's Nina Maria Potts, and we'll return to the life and work of Maya Angelou later in the show. European leaders have been reacting to the results of elections that took place across the bloc over the weekend. Elections that saw the far right-wing parties take up more seats in the European Parliament. In countries like France, the UK and Denmark, nationalist parties finished in first place, sending concerns that a wave of anti-EU sentiment could derail support for a closer European Union. I spoke to our correspondent in Brussels about how European leaders meeting there this week have been reacting.
Well, broadly speaking, the European Parliament looks more or less the same in terms of there being a majority of centre-right and centre-left parties, a similar mix of conservatives and green groups as well. But as you say, there has been a surge in support for far-right political parties who are anti-EU. They want more powers at national level. When you think of Front National in France, for instance, and the anti-EU party UKIP in Britain, beating all other parties in their respective countries, it certainly has rung alarm bells. I mean, most of these parties were on the political fringes up until a couple of years ago, barely. So their popularity doesn't necessarily translate into a great many more seats in the parliament itself, but EU leaders are being forced to react to what many agree was essentially a protest vote here in Europe, agreeing on the need for there to be changes. And we've had reactions already this week from EU leaders like Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron. He said the reforms really need to start in Brussels. The institutions here are too bossy, they're too interfering, in his words. France's President François Hollande also saying there needs to be severe changes. The economy needs to be a priority. Of course, he suffered a huge blow in support during these last elections. So certainly lots of talk about change in recent days.
So what now after the EU election, Sandra? There seems to be a turf war over who gets to be the new EU Commission president.
Indeed, and at the heart of it all is a vague EU treaty that fails to spell out exactly who gets to choose the candidate for the European Union's top job of Commission President. The European Parliament's interpretation is that it has a right to put forward a candidate based on a majority party win, which after this weekend turned out to be the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Juncker. The problem is he's not unanimously popular among all the European countries, so the UK is opposed. Prime Minister David Cameron says Mr. Juncker is too pro-EU. He's been around for too long. Other countries, Sweden, Hungary, are opposed to him as well. And Germany, crucially, is keeping quite tight-lipped about who they prefer. So in the meantime, other names are being thrown around. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, for instance, and even Helen Thorning-Schmidt, the Danish Prime Minister, who famously took a selfie with U.S. President Barack Obama in South Africa. She is another candidate as well being considered.
Our Europe correspondent, Sandra Gatman. Now, with less than 4 months to go until the people of Scotland vote on whether or not they want independence, politicians from both sides of the argument have been outlining the economic benefits of going solo or staying part of the UK. But with Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond saying Scots would be more than $1,600 better off if they vote to leave, and his rivals claiming that every Scottish person would be more than $2,000 richer if they stay, there's confusion for voters. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
Two separate press conferences, both in Scotland, and both promising more cash in the pockets of Scottish voters. It was a choice of just who to believe. Speaking in Edinburgh, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, campaigning to keep Scotland in the UK, accused Scottish National Party ministers of offering people a bogus bonus. The annual £1,400 Mr. Alexander is promising, that's around $2,300, is being called the UK dividend.
That dividend is our share of a more prosperous future. It's the money that will pay for better public services and a fairer society. Money for teachers in classrooms, for nurses and midwives. To put that £1,400 per person in context, on aggregate, it represents 11% of Scotland's total public expenditure. That's equivalent to around two-thirds of the total NHS budget in Scotland. It's almost as much as Scotland's whole education budget. So what does £1,400 mean to you and me? Well, £1,400, for example, is more than enough to pay for a year of free school meals for three children. £1,400 pays for 10 weeks of someone's basic state pension.
But the Better Together campaign, run by the UK government, hit a glitch just hours before the speech. It claimed it could cost up to $4.5 billion to set up an independent Scottish government. They'd calculated that figure using research from the prestigious London School of Economics. But the LSE academic behind the figures, Patrick Dunleavy, posted on Twitter that the Treasury's claim badly misrepresented his findings. Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond was quick to react, saying Danny Alexander's calculations had been blown to smithereens. He claims the good people of Scotland will actually be better off if going independent by the figure of $1,600. Where's that money from? Scotland's huge national reserves of oil and gas.
One of the most important things I ever got told when I was an economist is for most folk, anything over a million is just a big number. But 1.5 trillion is a very, very big number. That's the estimated value, the wholesale value of North Sea oil and gas over the next 40 or 50 years or so. What's a trillion? A trillion's 1,000 billion. What's a billion? 1,000 million. So it's 1,000 million. But the key point about that figure, and the key point to understand, and the key point which Sir Ian Wood understands, is that figure, that wholesale figure, that 1.5 trillion, that is actually greater than the value of oil and gas in wholesale terms over the last 40 years.
So Alex Salmond says the Scottish economy could be $8 billion per year better off by 2030 if they're independent. Danny Alexander disputes it and says that actually Scotland is facing an ageing population, declining oil reserves and potentially higher interest rates. Rosie Bloor from The Economist says some figures suggest Scotland could cope alone.
If you look at the accounts, and it is hard to get any kind of total precision to them because Whitehall doesn't break down all its tax revenues, for example, by geography. So it is hard to work it out totally. But people have done a very good job of it, and the result seems to be actually Scotland is kind of broadly fine. It's not being massively subsidised. But neither is it subsidising the South, if you like.
For voters, the economic arguments are confusing to say the least. A recent survey for Channel 4 in the UK found 51% of people in Scotland are planning to vote no in the referendum in September. 37% say they'll be backing independence, while 12% say they're not sure. What's for certain is that the battle to persuade voters either way will only increase before this monumental decision is made on September the 18th. Dan Whitehead, London.
And finally tonight, what better way to mark the life and artistic achievements of the late Maya Angelou than to hear from the woman herself? This is the celebrated poet with one of her most famous works, Still I Rise, from her anthology, And Still I Rise, published in 1978.
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear, or pain, or loss, or disappointment. And yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you? It's amazing. Wherever that abides in the human being, there is the nobleness of the human spirit. Despite it all, black and white, Asian, Spanish, Native American, pretty, plain, thin, fat, vowed or celibate, we rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh, does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally. There I go, rising.
Maya Angelou with one of her most famous works, Still I Rise. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, we look at Spain's divisive and brutal tradition of bullfighting.
It's a performance art in which an animal, at the end of which, is sacrificed and hence always dies. But it's a man showing his courage and skill and grace in the face of a wild beast. The idea that it's sporting, there is a great risk involved, but that's not why you go and watch it.
That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.